Okay, so I know that I think that I named this panel Shut Up and Draw, and I don't want y'all to think that shut up is really a rude thing to say. We mean it out of love. It's just verbal abuse through love, you know. Originally, it was shut the hell up, you know. So I thought shut up was nicer than shut the hell up. And also, it was inspired by Dan's book, Blah, Blah, Blah.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell him about that real fast, or are you going
to
do that?
Oh, no, we'll get to it. I have my
okay.
time. It's
okay,
all
very good.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do quick introductions, and then I'll tell you how the flow of the panel. And they did not sanction my introduction, so I just got to make up some random stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. My name is Sunny Brown. I own an information design company, and I am the leader of the Doodle Revolution, the self-proclaimed leader. And this is Jessica Hagee. She is a creative mercenary. That's what she calls herself, I think. And she also has an inexplicable knowledge of gemstones that I find confusing. And then this is Dan Rome. I'm sure you guys know of these people. Do y'all want to clap for us? We want to be welcomed. Thank you. Thank you. I'm very happy to be on a panel with these two.
We're happy to be on a panel with you.
Thank you. I'll give you a napkin later.
Thanks.
I'm in the middle of something.
You are.
So anyway, this is Dan Rome, and I think he's a pilot in his spare time, which I find interesting, and he's also the most successful of the three of us, which is annoying. So here's how this panel is going to work. I'm going to sort of set up why we're doing visual thinking and why we're advocating for visual grammar and visual literacy, and then I'm going to have you play a really silly game, and then I'm going to hand it over to Hagee, who's going to talk about other things like Santa Claus, and then Dan is going to talk about something a little more cerebral, I think. Is that fair?
I think so.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so I have a clicker, right? So I already did that part. Okay, so I'm just going to tell you a little short story. I was talking to a reporter from the Wall Street Journal the other day, and she was asking about the absence of what she called whiteboard culture in most companies, right? So she had been doing research on technology firms, and she noticed that when she was inside of these technology firms that they all had what she would refer to as drawable space, meaning that the walls were whiteboarded or they had whiteboard paint, or the desktops were available for drawing, or flip charts were everywhere, and so forth. So she called it a whiteboard culture. And she was asking why whiteboard culture is missing in most companies. How many of you would you say work in a whiteboard culture? See, are you lying to me? That's incredible. So that's self-selective for this audience. So most organizations that we all work across various organizations, and most of them don't actually have access to whiteboard culture, and there's consequences to that. And so, but she asked me the three reasons why I believe that it's absent from most places. And so here's three of the ones that keep coming up for me as I work around the world in a variety of situations, and these are the three that are the most common that I've noticed. And if you guys have different reasons, I would love to hear about them maybe over beer or something. So the first one is, I think we have nationwide lunacy around visual language. I think that we have some very serious misperceptions and misbeliefs and misinformation floating around about visual language. And part of the Doodle Revolution is about overturning those things. And that's some of you have Moleskines that have Doodle Revolution on there. So that's just a global campaign for visual literacy. But part of it is about overturning some of those misperceptions. And one of those misperceptions is that visual language is equal to art. Okay. And I'm going to show you a picture of visual language, and then you will know instinctively why it is not really considered art. So what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. Okay, here. So let me make some distinctions. Wait a second. That flipped all cray-cray.
That was the slide you asked me to put in 10 minutes ago. And you said put it in after slide 6.
Oh, my God.
But it couldn't possibly have gone there.
Okay,
so I put it somewhere else.
Close your eyes. Okay. Man, I knew I couldn't trust you.
We did. We tried to figure out where it would go.
You told us
really?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. It's probably my fault. I'm a visual thinker. I'm not logical, apparently. So this is what I would refer to. This is a sample of visual language, right? So the distinction for me between visual language and art, there's a few of them. One of them is that visual language is typically not emotive. It's not an emotional process in many cases when we're working with it in companies. Also, it's not really an act of self-expression. It's more about an act of understanding something. It is not about being beautiful or exemplary. So when people are using visual language, the idea is not to make something that's representative of a three-dimensional model of real life. And the level of beauty is not important, okay? And then finally, one of the distinctions from visual language and art is that it's not about ambiguity for the audience. So a lot of times art is about allowing the audience to interpret what's going on, but visual language for me is about being very clear about what's going on. So it's about eliminating ambiguity. So it's not art, but we still think, and I think you probably encounter this in your work, that people think visual language is art. And so that's something I want to kind of dispel as a myth. And here's another interesting thing. It sounds like I'm against art. I'm not against art. I'm not really artistic personally, but who's artistic in here? So like, what? So like, are y'all against art? I'm so confused. There was only like 12 of you that raised your hand. So here's why I'm not against art, but the reason why I want to separate visual language from art is a very specific reason for doing that, and is the following. We also have some crazy lunatic beliefs about art in this culture, and I'm sure you've encountered them if you work in the artistic space, which apparently none of you do. So one of them is that art is a luxury good. So if you are in the marketplace and you're trying to buy something, art on the continuum of, you know, necessity versus luxury, art is considered a luxury item. So it's like the first thing to go when times are tight. And if you're trying to sell the concept of visual thinking or visual language into a company, the last thing they're going to buy is art. They're not going to buy a piece of art from me. Okay. Also, these are beliefs that I encounter working in the world. They're not beliefs that I have. Okay, I'm just telling you what people, when I teach them, what they tell me. There are people who believe that you have to be trained to make art, so that you have to go to an art school, and it has to be a good art school, and you have to be really good at it, and so otherwise you shouldn't be doing it, or it's not really considered art, okay? Then there are people, and Dan, I know that you experience these people, who say that they're genetically incapable of making art. So, like, it's not in their lineage. Okay, and they tell me this, that in all seriousness, that it's a God-given skill and it cannot be developed. So the ability to draw and sketch is not something that they are like genetically capable of doing, which is preposterous, but I hear it all the time. Superfluous. It's also there in school and at work. People think if you incorporate art into your work life or your school life, that it's like, it doesn't make any sense. It has no place there. So they think that it's something extraneous that needs to be subtracted from work and school, which also is satanically inappropriate. If you're an artist, you must necessarily be starving, or you must have a drug addiction, or you must be mentally ill.
Isn't it funny that it's considered both a luxury, but the people who do it are all starving?
Right? Like, yeah. It's okay. Luxurious for the people who can afford to buy
it. Consumers.
Right, totally.
You need to talk more about the mentally ill part.
I think Hagee's suggesting that I'm mentally ill. You know, most incredible people are, apparently. I'm having a great time. Are y'all doing good? Doing good. And then finally, I want to say this too. People think, and I hear this all the time, people think that art or visual language, if you equate it to art, is not intellectually rigorous. They think that it's not a cerebral exercise. And so when you're doing something serious that has real gravitas, that it cannot possibly be art. So these are the things that I hear. So that's the reason why I don't want to equate visual language with art, because we have these insane perceptions about art too that make visual language a barrier to entry into corporations and nonprofits and academic places, right? So that's why we lack whiteboard culture. That's one reason. The other reason is that we have a strong tendency to judge our ability to, quote, draw. And so this is a picture of a woman. I was working at the AFL-CIO, and she stood up. She showed a picture of the face that she attempted to draw, and then she started making fun of herself, which they do all the time. Mm-hmm. And then everyone else started laughing and making fun, too. And it was, like, kind of funny, ha-ha, but it wasn't really funny, because what happens when you judge yourself is that you stop trying. And there's serious consequences to stopping trying, which means that you are essentially accommodating your own incapacitation. And that happens all the time. I see it everywhere I go. People are like, oh, ha ha, I'm really sucking it. And then they just shut down. So I'm not really okay with that instinct to judge ourselves. And this is another sort of parallel universe. So like a lot of people don't like their handwriting, right? Who here doesn't like their handwriting? Right? See, this is totally common. But can you imagine a world in which you were like, oh, I don't really like my handwriting, so I think I'm going to stop writing.
Email.
Like, right? That's true. That is true. Yeah, I mean, it's a parallel thing. So just because you don't like the way that you draw or you think that you're not good at it, that's not a legitimate reason for not doing it, because it's the literacy that it allows you is too powerful and too rewarding to deny yourself that thing. And here's the thing. Perfection is not the point of visual thinking and visual language, okay? This is a drawing from Copernicus about his epiphany about the heliocentric theory. And so there's two things that are actually wrong with this image if you're looking for perfection. The first is that the ellipses of the celestial bodies, the orbits that are surrounding the sun, are actually elliptical, but he drew them as circles. And the other thing that's wrong with it is that there's an implication inside of this image that those concentric circles, that the distance between those circles is accurately represented by this image. And Copernicus knew both of those things, that they were not, that both of those things were not accurately reflected by this. But you guys know Honey Badger, right? So Copernicus, like, don't give a shit. He's like, perfection is not the point of this image. The point of this image is to overturn people's notions about what was going on in the day in terms of our perception of where we are in the universe. So he didn't go out of his way to make it flawless. He wanted to make the point. And that's one of the things about visual language that's so awesome. Are y'all totally fascinated right now?
Totally.
I'm glad you brought up Honey Badger.
Oh, yeah. Hagee introduced me to Honey Badger.
To Copernicus?
No, to Honey Badger.
Oh.
Just the squabs.
Point this thing here.
What? All right, there.
Yeah, there you go. And if you haven't seen Honey Badger, please do that immediately. Okay, yeah, so the point is not perfection, okay? And so if you're in a quest for perfection, that's another reason to stop yourself from embracing visual language, okay? So it's not the point. This is the point of visual language, improved thinking. This is two images taken from university and high school students where they're studying the particle motion relative to temperature. This is in a science class. And then they're studying the concept of revolving versus rotating in planetary motion. And so they actually did comparative studies. This was in the journal Science. Dan emailed me this. Thank you, Dan. And they actually showed that students who were trying to understand these concepts based on reading textbooks had a much lower comprehension and retention and insights into that information than did students who were drawing that information. And these weren't like certain types of students. These are just normal across the board random sampling of students, you know. So this is the point of visual thinking and visual language. And these students, once the teacher was telling them that they weren't supposed to make art, it wasn't about the beauty of the piece, then they were liberated to just pursue the content without worrying about the judgment of how gorgeous it is. And they had, there was a reward for having done that, which was understanding. And that's the point. And then here's the other thing that I encounter when I'm operating in the world. I noticed that even if you get past that point where you're like, okay, I'm not going to judge myself, and I totally understand why it's valuable, then we don't know how to do it. We actually have a complete gap in knowledge of how to take something to work. I mean, that's the second biggest question I get is like, okay, I'm convinced, and I believe, and I don't want to judge myself, so how do I do it? None of us on some level who were raised in this culture have the tools and the techniques for applying visual language inside of the subject matters in which we work. And so that's a huge gap, and that is troublesome. So I would say that we're visually illiterate by and large as a culture. Most of us are, and it's a global phenomenon too. I notice it everywhere that I teach. So the definition of literacy, just to be clear, is the ability to identify and understand, interpret, and create and communicate. And the reason why literacy is powerful and totally important in your life is because it allows you to participate fully in society. That's why literacy is important in nations everywhere and around the world and in societies, because people's potential is able to be reached or maximized when they become literate. And so I think that we are visually illiterate, and that's like sounds so rude, like you're all illiterate. I'm just saying I was illiterate for a long time myself, and I'm still developing my own literacy in this space. But we're only half illiterate, right? Like the top three, I think we're pretty good at when it comes to visual information. It's the bottom two that we're lacking. We're not very confident in creating and communicating a concept ourselves. And they have also shown that the interpretation of other people's visual work is not as profoundly powerful in terms of cognitive impact as it is when you make it yourself. So those are, you know, major things that I think are deleted, unfortunately, from our capacity to think, really.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Because I'm looking at this. Does anybody know what is the actual derivation of the word literacy? Where does that come from? Does anybody know? I don't know, but I've got to believe that it has something to do with reading, doesn't it? Lit? I mean, there's got to be... Because I think there's a flaw in the whole word.
Yeah.
I mean, I am with you. We're going to... I would like to show a way I think that we can become more visually literate, but I think it's interesting to think back. Mm-hmm. What do we mean when we say we're literate is that we have the ability to read.
Yeah.
We don't have the ability to see.
Right.
And what we're going to make happen is get people, all of us, to be able to become able to see mm-hmm. better in addition to being able to read.
Yeah,
I want to find out. Does anyone know? Can someone look up? Where does it come from? Knowing your letters. So it's basically knowing how to read, knowing those little symbols, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So we've already got a problem using the word.
Right.
All right.
That's really interesting. Was that in Wikipedia?
See, they messed us up right from the beginning. Is it Greek? Right. Where did it come from?
Probably.
Yeah? So we've had this for a couple of thousand years. We've thought that to be smart means to be able to read.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a problem.
Yeah. Well, and that distinction was like enforce the socioeconomic disparities.
Absolutely. We'll go on with that.
Totally.
We're
going to
go into politics later on.
Right? We're running for office, people. Yeah. I got to stop saying honey badger. I don't give a shit if I do that, though. Okay, so here's three reasons why visual literacy matters. There are hundreds of reasons why visual literacy matters, but these are some of the top three that just came to my mind when I was thinking about why we work at this intersection of words and pictures. One of them is that information density is redonkulous, and I love the word redonkulous. I will use it as often as I possibly can. You like that? And so the beauty of imagery is that that Copernican image was accompanied by 405 pages of text and equations, but it was beautifully crystallized and summarized in that image. You know what I mean? So imagery has this density that allows you to articulate complex concepts without having to go through this elaborate process of the blah, blah, blah. And I think in this age, Clay Shirky, the technologist, talks about how you need a filter. It's filter failure more than information density that's actually the problem. And I think that being able to draw and sketch is a form of filtering, which is really a powerful tool that's actually accessible to anyone that has hands and eyes. And you don't even need hands to draw. You could draw with your feet.
Gross.
You can clean your feet.
You can.
Right? I can do Rubik's Cubes with my feet, too.
So I
can't, really. Don't repeat that.
Thinking about it.
So this is the other thing. So I make up words a lot, and antagonasty is my latest. And what it means, it's like redonkulous, right? It's a higher level of antagonistic. And my producer's here, and she makes fun of me for making up words. And I was like, I do not inventicize words. Please stop confabulating. And she was like, what is wrong with you? So this is a crazy story. I'm sure you've heard of this guy. Do you guys know who this is? Kamala, the Ugandan giant? He's a WWF wrestler. Don't worry about it. So from like the old school. So anyway, there is a company called Intellectual Ventures, and their job is to invent and patent technologies and products. And, you know, so the thing that they have over five, it's growing rapidly, and they have over the head guy. His name is Nathan Myhrvold. Some people, he's a really contentious character. Some people hate him. Yeah.
No.
Did somebody hiss?
Oh.
Right. Yeah. They call him the patent troll. Totally a troll. See, we can draw a picture of that. Draw me a picture of a troll.
Okay.
Poor Nathan, he's going to have a troll picture of himself. We'll do that for you, sir. So the crazy thing is, these guys have, Nathan himself has over, yes, Nathan himself has over 500 patents holding, and he's got hundreds pending. Can you put his name?
No.
Is that labeling?
This is a potato troll.
It looks kind of like a booger.
It's a booger, exactly. Don't paint with your
pizza. Just put 500 plus. 500. It is a booger. It's a booger troll.
Time check.
Potato booger troll. Okay. Okay, so here's the thing. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries.
I know, I'm having fun, I'm sorry. All right, so here's the thing. The reason why I bring them up is because they have these things called invention sessions, in which they bring together all these people, and then they invent, like, in 1 hour up to 60 potentially patentable ideas. And the thing is, the way that they do that is that they infuse visual language throughout their process. It's not novel for them, and it's not, like, beautiful either, but their literacy is very high in that space, and that is accommodating their cognitive performance in a serious way, right? So, I know. Okay, and so I won't elaborate on this, but just suffice it to say that we live in an age where these claims that I'm making are backed up by evidence-based science. I don't need to, I'm not like a hippie, and I'm like, everybody, let's get together and draw trolls and flowers. You know, there's like, what?
I want to draw trolls and flowers.
Yeah, she's a hippie. She likes to draw trolls and flowers. You can draw another one while we're loitering. Okay. So my point is that there are parts of society that are already using this type of skill, and they're tech firms, obviously, since y'all live in whiteboard cultures, but it needs to be accessible to the rest of us. That's my point. So let's play a super quick game, because Dan's going to teach us all visual grammar, and so is the Hagues, but I want y'all to play a game. Do y'all have napkins and a little Moleskine and a pen? And I'm sorry, we didn't have enough Moleskine. We didn't know we were going to be in a room this big, so I didn't bring that many Moleskines. So this game, you get a partner.
I'm done.
You should just carry on.
He's Josh Trolls.
It makes you feel comfortable.
Let's do the game.
Okay, game. It's called Acronym. So everybody has a partner? So I want you to tell your partner, think of a five-letter word. And
the
then,
next slide shows that, right? Can we do it there?
No, it doesn't. No. It's just that.
Oh, well, that's how to spell acronym.
You can write the instructions while I'm...
Shall I write the instructions?
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Five-letter word. Find a partner. Think of a five-letter word.
Okay, so this is you.
Got it?
Find a partner.
That part shouldn't take that long.
Okay.
And partner. Then what's going to happen is I want you to tell the partner your word, and then they have to make an acronym out of that word.
Five letters, right?
So if your word's plant, then you're going to say, like, you know, people like ants, not today. You know, whatever. Make it nonsensical. It doesn't have to be this awesome acronym. Again, perfection is not the point. Y'all got it? Are y'all good?
So step number one, to find a partner?
Yeah.
All right. And then step number two is to make up a word.
Yeah, not make up a word, a real word.
A real word.
Yeah, five letters.
And then make up an acronym for that.
Yes.
All right, good.
Do y'all got it?
This is still very lettery.
Yeah, no. Well, they're going to draw it.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, you don't have to write your phrase down. Just have it, because the next step is something else. Okay? Next step is to draw your phrase. How do you feel about that?
To draw your what?
What? Yeah, either one. If you have both, you could share with someone else. Okay, so you get it? You guys, so you invented your phrase. You have your word. You invented a phrase, an acronym based on the word. And then I want you to attempt to draw whatever the concept is, okay? And do not stress yourself out about it. Like, if your phrase is nonsensical, just try to make something that represents that phrase, even if it's crazy. You understand? Five letters.
Must
sure,
be
you can
five.
Go ambitious if you want to be ambitious and do six. Totally.
I don't know. Are we going to let him do six letters?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah, as long as it's not four letters, right. You know.
That's something hippies do. Six letters.
Yeah. And then I'm done. And then I'm done.
We're good. We're cool.
Okay, it's all good.
Oh, good. Well, I thought it was time check, like I was rambling.
No. Well, you
were. Well, I just, you know, I'm trying to, you know. You got to keep it moving along?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chop, chop.
Well, they need 2 minutes to, like, think and draw.
Sure.
No.
Yeah.
Out on them.
You're left-handed.
I am.
Mm-hmm.
Are you left-handed?
No.
Oh, like,
no.
I was going to feel left out.
I have lots of dyslexia skills if you want me to write backwards.
Oh, I can write left-handed if I write backwards. I've practiced that, like, a la Leonardo. They're at the bookstore.
Yeah, they can pay.
I can give them that one.
Because we could give it to somebody who doesn't
know. How are we going to do that? It's going to be chaos.
We're just going to throw it and whoever it hits.
Fair enough. Okay. No, that's fine. The only thing is it's holding my computer up.
Okay. How's that progress? Okay, so we'll just have time to share one. Who wants to share one that they think is really funny or really awesome? Okay, yes. Yes. Snake was the word. Whoa. Did y'all hear that? Slithering nocturnal animal kills elephant.
Animal.
Dude. Oh, but it couldn't kill the honey badger.
Elephant.
That's amazing. You win a book. Can you come get a book? Dan has one to give away. Come.
Who is that man?
Yeah. Okay, so many of you are wondering what is the point of that exercise. And I have to say, one of the points is to actually put blood flow into your visual cortex. So the act of visualizing strange things. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yay. Yeah, so that was really my point, because Dan's going to do some substantive visual thinking. So my point was to just awaken your visual cortex if it was sleeping. Okay, cool. Thank you for playing. Okay, Higgs. Yeah.
How does the remote control work?
Oh, here.
Which one do I go?
Oh, yeah, I was going to,
Great.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm going to pick up where Sunny left off, where she's talking about how visual thinking is a problem, that we don't do it, that we need to do it, all sorts of things. And I'm just going to drop in a few examples of where you can throw it into things that you're working on, thinking about, running into. So just add images to pretty much anything, and you can get a lot more out of your conversations. Sometimes it's really difficult to articulate with words. We're not all elegant poets in all times, and sometimes you just need a visual to be able to point out what exactly the problem is and how things work. It can happen with a whiteboard, just from like here to there, with there to here. You can identify direction and problem and where he touched you on the doll. You can use it to work around linguistic, cultural, personal things. If you're dealing with people who use opposite metaphors that you do or different things like that, you can sometimes just draw a picture and find a common ground that you wouldn't have with just words. Mm-hmm. I was told I cannot sail around the world in a broken teacup. And just thinking about that, it's like, well, that's a big metaphor that I've never run into before. But now that I've drawn it out and seen it, I'll remember it for a really, really long time.
Mm-hmm. As will we all.
You can't sail around the world in a broken teacup.
Where did you hear that from? Who said that?
An Icelander.
Really?
An Icelander. Is that why they get the Viking hat?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Icelanders have a lot of really weird metaphors. They're fantastic.
Interesting.
Also, drawing can sometimes help you memorize things. You can create your own visual mnemonic just with a doodle or seeing something on the page. You can recall the moment where you were when you were doodling it. Sometimes to-do lists, you just need to know what's going on, and you're almost done with something, and you just haven't figured it out yet. You can use visuals for all sorts of in-the-clutch situations where you're just sort of sitting there thinking about something, needing to move on from there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When tensions are high, a lot of people tend to agree and disagree at the same time when they're talking, and this leads to a lot of tension and confusion, and sometimes it's, I want dinner, and what is dinner? Well, dinner is meat. Well, that's not meat. What's this? What's that? And it's, I had cats and dogs, but then I decided to put a cougar in there because he was on the honey badger. And sometimes with visuals, you can really say, no, this is what I'm trying to say, and you can articulate with just a few scratches of a pen. Mm-hmm. And finally, because you can. Visuals can capture things that you wouldn't be able to talk about otherwise. This is just an image of a little girl saying, but mommy can't be Santa Claus, and thinking about, like, what is she picturing in her mind? Is it, what's going on? And so that, there really are fantastic, weird things. You can
you totally just besmirched Santa for, like, everyone in here.
I don't know. I think this is the image of South by Southwest for me. Because you can. Go Santa.
It's your birthday.
I love it.
I wish I had a rack like that.
We know what you want for Christmas.
I need the green bra.
I'll buy you one and he'll buy you the other one.
Thank God, because we can.
Because we can.
That's the screenshot, right? Next year, South by Southwest 2013. There it is. Because you can.
Good times, y'all. So, yeah, visuals, add a visual to anything. It'll get a lot more out of your conversation, out of your workplace. You'll get more out of your memory, out of your brain, and it's fun to do. And that's my contribution to today.
Beautiful.
I really do. I want to keep that one. I just can see it here now. You know, South by Southwest. 2013. We got to go back to the other one, right? Because you can.
Because you can.
All right. See y'all next year. All right. So, I want to take some of the things that Sunny has been talking about and Jessica was talking about and apply them to some things that I have seen out there in the real world where I think pictures start to become incredibly powerful for us in ways that we don't often think about. And what I want to share with you is something I call a tale of two charts. So we're going to start out with a chart. This is a guy named Austin Goolsbee, who up until about 2 months ago was the head of the President's Board of Economic Advisors. And Austin used to really like to draw a lot of charts. Now he's gone back to the University of Chicago, where he's a professor of economics. He wants to describe complex economic policy ideas. He draws them with charts. And many of Austin's charts were very clear about some really questionable or dubious underpinnings of things that we start to look at in our own society from an economic perspective. And so many of Austin's charts became poster children for many of the people who were involved in the Occupy movement. Many of the charts that were made by Austin and other people like him started to appear on billboards and posters that were being shown by people at Occupy. This is another guy who likes to draw a lot of charts. This is Glenn Beck. And he has drawn lots and lots of charts, often that are undermining exactly the charts or taking exactly the opposite perspective of the charts that Austin would have drawn. Oh, you want the pen?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Can you put some boobs on him. Yeah.
They're crooked.
Oh, boy.
You can see how quickly this would devolve into just silliness.
So what's happened? It's going to be an interesting transition now. So what's happened is this fellow's charts have become the poster children for another group. At the other side of the spectrum, so many of the people that are involved very heavily in the Tea Party looked at the charts that Glenn Beck has drawn and thought that they're particularly compelling or insightful. So the question that I want to ask is, okay, you know, we know that both of these charts, the two charts that I've shown you, are actually the statement charts of America these days because both of them have been made fun of by Jon Stewart. So we know that these are the charts that really kind of define the polls of where we sit today. So the real question is, you know, who's right? And you know what? I don't want to get into the content of what either of these fellows was saying, but the fact is they're both right. And I'm not talking about what they're saying, but I'm talking about the way that they're saying it, because they're using pictures to convince. And we now have scientific evidence. This is a brand new study that just came out a couple of months ago from Nieman Labs, and I will give you the quote. There's the best part of it all. It says, and this makes absolutely no sense to me, I had to draw this out, but basically what this new scientifically validated study tells us is that graphical corrections are also found to successfully reduce incorrect beliefs among potentially resistant subjects and perform better than the equivalent textual correction. What that means... Beautiful. Is that if you want someone, if you want to convince someone, draw them the picture. It works much better than the words. If you want to convince someone, draw them the picture. And actually what the report said was something very subtle and very interesting. It said not just if you want to convince someone, but what it was saying is if you and are sitting opposite someone who fundamentally disagrees with you, the more you try to convince them with words to agree with you, the less likely you are to have that happen. But at the moment when you draw a picture that represents graphically what you are talking about, all of the sudden the likelihood of them agreeing with you goes right through the roof.
Oh, can I give an example?
Go.
So you guys, I'm not particularly... you know, in love with the idea of being married, but I finally was like, okay, fine. People do it. I was in France for 3 months. We did a home exchange, and my fiance, I was trying to explain to him that I'm getting older. I'm 34, and I was like, my eggs are going to shrivel, and if you're, you know, obsessed with children, then there's a shelf life going on here. So we talked about this for months. And finally, I just drew him a timeline, and I was like, if you want to be engaged for this amount of time, and you want to be married this amount of time before we have a baby, and then you want two babies, then the timeline is not lying to you. And shit you not, he engaged he proposed like 2 days later. You know? And we've been talking about it for months.
There we go.
Yeah.
There you have it.
Yeah.
The proof.
There it is.
So the question for all this scientific study and anecdotes is, well, duh.
Right.
Like, we needed someone to tell us?
Right.
Of course we know this to be true. If you want to convince someone, if that idea is complicated and they're just not getting it, you draw them the picture. Well, no, of course there were no pictures in the broadcast. There were statistical data tables in the footnotes in the summary section, as always will happen.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So fine, you know, what we're going to do is we're talking, we should be drawing more. All right, great. Well, I think one of the problems that all of us face, it's exactly what Sonny started out with, is many of us think, well, okay, I want to be more visual, but you know what? I can't draw. Therefore, I can't do it. Well, hogwash. We're going to show you how to do it.
Yeah.
And in order to do this, I want to show you one more chart first. This to me is probably the most influential back-of-the-napkin sketch ever made. So I live out in San Francisco. We're down here in Austin. We need to go out to D.C. We need to go to Washington, D.C. Not only do we need to travel to another place, we need to travel to another time. We want to go to the year 1974 out in Washington, D.C. There was a very prominent economist in those days, a guy named Arthur Laffer. If you've heard this story, raise their hand. If you've heard the Laffer story, how many? Okay, for the rest of you who have it, this is the best one. This is the most influential napkin ever. So Arthur Laffer was a USC economist. He was a real friend of the Ford administration back in 1974. He was very conservative in his fiscal views. So one night he went out to a bar in Washington, D.C. with two senior aides from President Ford. And we don't know what they were drinking, but we know what they were drawing because the napkin became part of public record. So they were talking about taxation. And Laffer said, as they were continuing to drink, he said, you know, I've got an idea. There's something I've been thinking about. Do you mind if I draw it out? The guy said, no, please go ahead. So on his napkin, he drew a very simple little XY plot, something we've probably all done at one time or another. And he said, okay, we're talking about taxation. So on the horizontal axis, let's plot out the percent tax rate that the government charges us on our income tax from 0% up to 100%. So this is to say we're not paying any income tax. This is to say we're paying 100% of our income out as income tax. And on the vertical scale, let's plot out how much money the government actually collects from $0 up to lots and lots of dollars. Now, keep in mind, this is going on in a bar. So they're talking about this as he's drawing it out. And he says, okay, guys, bear with me. So if the government charges us 0% income tax, how much money is the government going to bring in? Well, zero. But he said, think about this. If the government charges us 100% income tax, how much money is the government going to bring in? Also zero, because no one will work. If we have to pay every penny of every dime of every dollar that we earn, if it comes in one pocket and goes right out the other one in tax, what would be the point of having a job? There'd be nothing. Why would you work? Just go to the beach. Just forget about it. So he said, what happens is there's actually a curve that goes something like this. And isn't it interesting, said Arthur Laffer, Dr. Laffer at that point, gentlemen, isn't it interesting at some point reducing the rate of taxation actually increases the amount of money the government collects? Now, the two guys who were sitting in the bar with him that night, these two guys said, that napkin's really cool. Can we take it back to President Ford? I doubt if they actually said it's very cool. They said, that's a very compelling idea, Dr. Laffer. May we take that napkin back to President Ford? And he said, yes. They took it back to President Ford. President Ford liked the napkin sketch. It made sense to him. It clarified an idea that had been in his mind ill-formed, but now it was well-formed because it was visual. Ford passed the napkin sketch on the Republican National Committee. The Republican National Committee passes the napkin sketch on to the economics team of a guy named Ronald Reagan. That napkin sketch literally became the first time anybody had ever seen or heard of the idea of supply-side economics. Reaganomics was started that night by Arthur Laffer and these two guys in that bar in Washington, D.C., on the back of that napkin. Now, where this story gets really intriguing is, you want to know who those two guys were that were sitting with Dr. Laffer that night? Former Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld and former Vice President Dick Cheney. Those were the three guys that were sitting in the bar that night inventing, on the back of a napkin, supply-side economics and Reaganomics. Now, the question is, you know, who says a simple little picture doesn't have power? A simple little picture has absolute and ultimate power. It's exactly what we've been talking about in all of this. Why do we want to make sure that we draw more? Because when we draw things, when we can see something and it makes sense to us, we believe in it and we understand it in a way we simply cannot with words alone. It's a neurobiological process. It's a cognitive process. It's testable. It's knowable. We are of two minds, and I'm not talking about left brain, right brain. I mean, left brain, right brain thinking. Yeah. Everybody knows about left brain, right brain thinking, right? Forget everything you know, because right. Most of what we think we know is wrong.
That's true.
It is true that of all mammals have a bilobed neocortex, the top of the brain that's on top. All mammals have a bilobed neocortex. It's split in half. As far as we can tell, and tests will change this over time, but as far as we can tell right now, it seems that humans are the only mammal in which the two sides of the brain, the two hemispheres, are of actually slightly different form and do have different function. What is proving to be kind of wrong about the way we think about right brain, left brain thinking is it's not as simplistic as we believe. It's not fair to say that one side of our brain is analytic and one side of our brain is synthetic. It doesn't work that way. But what we do know, it appears that half of our brain has evolved to really be good at looking at little bits of things, to take the world in front of us and break it into the little pixels, to break it into the little pieces. And the other half of our brain has evolved to glue everything together. So in order to read, for example, it's not true that reading takes place in half of our brain. No, one half recognizes the words and the letters, and the other half recognizes the paragraphs and put them together. So the point is, we are of these two minds. Mm-hmm. The way I like to think about it is represented in this picture. In the end of the day, this is really what we end up with. This is the way our mind really does look at the world. Two completely different ways. Both are right. Both are accurate. But as you can see, they're not the same. This thing is not the same as that thing. This one, we have the words to describe, so we teach to it. We test for it. We train for it. We have grammar. We have literacy. Everything that helps us quantify this way of looking at the world. The report that we were looking at is entirely this. Well, what about this little dude over here? This actually takes up far more of our processing, visual processing. You know, the part of our brain, all of our neurons in our brain, about 65% of every neuron on our brain is focused on vision in one way or another. It's far more than is focused on verbal processing, far more than is processing memory. We are, by virtue of being human, for the most part, walking, talking, visual processing machines, and yet we have totally neglected it. We've beaten it out of us, and that's going to stop. Mm-hmm. So here's what I want to do. We've got a couple of minutes. I want to draw with you. I want you to draw with me, all of us, something that I call vivid grammar. This is the beginnings of something that I really think can start to help us put together the grammar that we've learned in being literate and being verbal into the beginnings, perhaps, of a grammar that can help us be more visual. So does everybody have something to draw on? Does everybody have something to draw with?
Yeah, and if you have a napkin and a Moleskine, will you share with your other people? I know that you have two things.
All right, so we're good. Is everybody properly equipped? All right, so here's what we're going to do. On your napkin or on your, can I just call it a moleskin?
I know, right? He hates it when I say moleskin. It's like saying IKEA instead of IKEA. Yeah. He's like, oh my God.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just not.
When you that's say skin, it pretentious. Sounds like an animal.
But it's spelled moleskin. I know it's the improper pronunciation.
Who says it's moleskin?
Yeah.
Okay, and then who says it's moleskin?
So you're actually right.
These three are smarter than
me. Take a bow. So here's what we're going to do on our moles thing.
Yeah.
Our or on our napkin is I'd like you to draw a pretty big square. So on your napkin where you have some space, I'd like you to draw a pretty big square that takes up as much as you can. I'm pretty sure everybody can do that. Whether we think we can draw or not, I'm willing to guess that most people can probably draw a square. And now what I'd like you to do is divide that square as best as you can into thirds. We're going to do a little bit of sort of visual origami here. Everybody following along so far? Now I'd like you, oh, we did it in thirds. I'd like you to label it vivid grammar. Because I would like you to take this napkin or this moleskine back with you. And seriously, when you do feel motivated to try to create a visual description of what you're thinking about verbally, this I think might be a toolkit that will help do that. So let's see if I can remember how to do this. What I'd like you to do is take the middle stripe, this one right here, and divide it further into thirds. And then the last division we're going to make is divide the bottom one in half. So by the time we're done, we should have something that looks like that. Okay, we have our big square. It's been divided up into thirds. Three in the middle, two on the bottom, one on the top. Okay, so does everybody have something that looks more or less like that? Okay, this is the framework for grammar. Now, here's the interesting thing. It was painful to do it, but I thought if we're going to try to create a visual grammar, which many, many people have tried to do before, and they tend not to stick very well because they tend to be created out of nothing. They tend to say to be created out of a vacuum. Since we've already got the grammar of reading and writing, we already understand what nouns are and verbs are and prepositions and adjectives. Why don't we just take what we already know and put a visual spin on it? So that's what we're going to do as we fill these out. It turns out, I didn't realize this until I started to study it. All of English grammar is based on only 8 items. Nouns, verbs, prepositions, adjectives, adverbs, tense. There's only 8 things. Any poem, any screenplay, any novel, any report that's ever been written in English, and this goes for most of the European languages, although it's not too far off, it turns out, from many of the Asian languages as well, is composed of nothing but those 8 pieces. There's nothing else. Those are the main things that we learn in grammar. So let's go ahead and start. The first thing I'd like to do is in the top square, I'd like us to draw nouns. The way we represent nouns, what are nouns? They're persons, places, or things. They're physical objects. So what I'd like you to do is say, draw a person, you know, draw a thing, maybe draw a little car. I don't know, draw a box. Just draw some nouns. What are some things that you can think of? And we're going to call those who and what. So when we want to ask the question, who did it, or what did they do, or what does it look like? Verbally, we would use a noun. You know, we would say it was a mole, it was a mugwump, it was a troll, it was what have you. So that's slice number one. Slice number two over here, I'd like you to talk about how much. When we don't want to worry about what the thing is, but we want to count them, we want to describe their quantities. I have 10 mugwumps. I have 1,000,000 mugwumps. What we do is we draw a little chart, a visual display of number, which, by the way, happens to correspond exactly to adjectives, adjectives of number. When we want to represent the numeric adjectives of something, how many, we draw a chart. We're going to continue on because the next thing is, okay, so where does it happen? We've accounted for who's and what's. We've accounted for how many. Now, where does it happen? We draw a little map. So a map might be something like, you know, here's my house, and here's the river, and here's the buried treasure, and here's the way to get to it. And you'll notice that these three pictures look completely different from each other, these three types of pictures. What does where? These are prepositions. Inside, above, to the left, below. These are the prepositions. We're building our entire sentence. We're building our entire visual grammar just from the pieces of grammar that we already had, and we're giving them a visual aspect to it. So the next one is, when does it happen? Which, of course, corresponds to tense. And the picture that we want to draw when is we draw a timeline. Now we've accounted for tense. The last one, the last independent one, is how. How does it all happen? How does it all interact? And what we would do is we want to represent that. We draw a little flowchart. Well, this thing happened, which caused this to happen, which caused this other thing to happen, or maybe this thing over here. So what we're drawing is we're drawing a little flowchart, which represents verbs. What happened? Well, he ran to her, and she hit him and went home. So we've got verbs now. And then the last one is we add all of these things up together, and we've got why. And it's kind of horrible, but the picture that we have to draw if we want to describe why is we draw a multivariable plot, kind of like an Laffer curve thing, where we've got an X, a Y, and then we start to map in all kinds of different dimensions of data, and we can actually see how things interact from a visual perspective, which is really a phrase. Please do.
Another factor of this math that you're using is if you think about even mathematics, the equals being is a verb of being.
That's right.
The adds this over that. There are sentences in every math equation which are verbal. Take that one step into visual, and it's all right there too.
So what's the quadratic equation? Does anyone know? It's like
a squared equals
a
squared plus b squared.
A
squared equals a squared plus b squared.
I'm 42. Talking about the quadratic equation now, isn't it? A squared plus B.
B squared equals C squared. What equal?
who knows the quadratic equation?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh yeah. A squared plus B plus C equals zero.
We got this.
This is very important. Down.
The interesting thing about that formula that nobody can remember. Because it's stated out, unless a few of us can remember it. You know what? You can draw it out, and it makes perfect sense. Let's say I have 2 squared. Where did the 2 squared come from? Well, if you make a square, which is 2 on each side. And let's say I wanted, so this is 2 squared. If I wanted to add one more square to that, I wanted to add, you know, plus 1. If I want to get 3 squared, how do I get 3 squared? I take my 2 squared, I add on another 2 and another 2 plus 1. Here's where that plus 1 came from, because I have to put the corner in. You following what I'm showing? It's incredible. You can do the same thing with quadratic equations. Mm-hmm. Most math can be represented visually. And when you do a formula that you had to memorize back in 8th grade, which clearly less than 1% of us can remember, if you just showed it, you never have to remember the formula because it makes perfect sense. It's all visual. Yeah,
there's a
forget
woman,
the formula.
There's a woman named Vi Hart that actually has a lot of really cool tutorials called Mathematical Doodling. So it's
really? What's her name?
Vi, V-I-H-A-R-T, Vi Hart. She was in the Times the other day, and I will be recruiting her for the Doodle Revolution very soon.
Recruit away.
I will.
Yeah.
Yeah, put her in the basement.
So I'm going to leave this with the following thought. This is just the beginning, and... if you're interested in where this can go and how this model of vivid grammar can be applied to literally taking any idea that we would normally try to describe verbally and come up with a way to describe it visually so that it does the things that Jessica was talking about and it does the things that Sunny was talking about without having to believe that we can draw. It's not about drawing. It's about thinking visually. In order to think visually, we just have to see what's in front of us. Look at it, see it, and then just, you know, draw a goofy little picture of the same thing. It doesn't matter how good it is. You know, and if you are curious on how any of this can apply, you know, there are a couple of books out there that you might think about.
You better name mine.
Yeah, so this is the beginning of it. But I want to conclude with one last thought, and then we've got actually time for questions and answers.
No, I don't think so.
Don't we have?
We have 7 minutes.
We got a little bit of time. So, some of you have seen this picture before. I just love this picture. So why is it, you know, we're up here talking about the amount of our brain that's dedicated to vision, the brilliance of using pictures to try to describe complex ideas. Why is this work? Well, clearly at some point in our past, it mattered to us to be able to see the thing that was going to try to eat us so that we could run away from it. Mm-hmm. So the question is, you know, why do we still have it? You know, so we can see the PowerPoint that's going to eat us and be able to run away from it by drawing our way out of it. So I'm done with my part, too.
Good.
So thank you.
Did you want to... Yeah. Dan has... thank you. That was amazing.
Thank you.
Dan, I don't know if you were going to do a plug for his... He does have a really two incredible books, one called Back of the Napkin. That's why, hence the napkins. And the other one is Blah, Blah, Blah. I'm surprised you didn't plug it. And you can plug my book now, anytime.
Game Storming?
Anytime, yeah. I have a book called Game Storming. It's about visual thinking techniques in the workplace, mostly. And it's super fun. Thanks for bringing it up.
And Jessica has a book called Indexed.
Yes. And Hagee, y'all know Jessica's work. This is Indexed. It's one of the best blogs of the century. I'm sure you've seen it if she showed you pictures of it. Yeah.
You're welcome. And I've got my book, Blah, Blah, Blah. And kind of an irony is that all three of us happen to be represented by the same literary agent.
Mm-hmm.
So
he's a good guy.
Yeah. So I'm done, Sonny. It's all yours.
Cool. Do y'all have questions? Because we meant to leave more time. Oh, he knew the quadratic equation, so you can definitely ask.
Yeah. This is worth the whole price of admission for South by Southwest right here. You ready? This is a tablet PC. Okay, fair enough. It's just a tablet PC, so I can draw on the screen. To prove it, you know, if I open it up, it's a ThinkPad, you know.
Yeah.
But the thing is, what's kind of remarkable about it is the software that I'm using, you're not going to believe it, the software that we're using. It's PowerPoint. Yes.
Yeah.
PowerPoint, I hate to say it. No, don't say anything bad about PowerPoint. PowerPoint has the best on-screen built-in drawing tools of any application out there. And I'm a Mac guy. You know, this is like sometimes difficult to say. The thing is, I gave a talk at Microsoft. It's one time I got a standing ovation because at the end of the talk, the same question came up. And the subtext was, what, you know, Apple product are you using to draw live on screen? And I said, I'm using PowerPoint, and the room erupted. Very few people know that PowerPoint has the drawing tools built in, and they're incredibly good.
Yeah.
They're very, very simple. The way you access them, since you asked, you know, if I wanted to try to draw a picture here, how would I even do it? Forgive me for this. You know, yeah, reality. So let's say I wanted to draw a circle. What, am I going to go here and pick a circle shape and do that? Ugh. How do I draw in PowerPoint? I can't, so forget about it. No, what you do is you go into slide mode. And you see these little icons down here that nobody ever looks at? How many million, hundreds of millions of people? This isn't every version of PowerPoint. You just pick the pen. And guess what? Then you draw. And what's really amazing, it's incredible, yeah. Now watch this. When you're done, you exit, you end, and it says, would you like to keep it? And you say keep. And now it's just giving you a vector object that you can cut and paste and keep forever and copy from file to file. And it took, anyway, there's lots of great drawing software out there, but yeah, PowerPoint.
Does anybody have any other questions? I think we have like 4 minutes. Don't be shy. Are there mics to pass around? What's happening?
You said a lot.
I overwhelmed you with like brilliance. Okay. We like stupid questions.
Pen and paper.
Yes, absolutely. Because people often ask that, like, what's the difference between digital drawing and, you know, what kind of tool? It's the process. It's not the tool. You know, I mean, pen and paper is a really apt thing. And then if you want to move beyond that, I like Sketchbook a lot. I like Autodesk Sketchbook a lot. Illustrator is a little too complicated for people that are just trying to do simple drawing. But yeah, it's the process.
And if you've got an iPad, I use Adobe Ideas all the time.
Yeah. Yes? I'm glad you asked that because the Doodle Revolution, if you got one of those mole flesh items that I handed out... That is what the Doodle Revolution is about. It is about empowering other people to evangelize the practice. And so if you go to doodlerevolution.com, there's articles, there's videos, there's other tutorials, there's PDFs, there's things that allow you to sort of understand it enough to explain it. Because I know that bringing it into a culture is one of the hardest challenges that people face. So that's one of the points of the revolution. Yeah. Thank you for asking. Yes, green shirt man over
there's
there.
There's a mic over there.
Thank you all for coming. I didn't mean to inspire that part. Are you talking to Dan?
Sure.
How to use the grammar that was shown on screen in an actual real-world situation.
Okay, so, you know, here we are at South by Southwest, where probably half the people in here have got a new service offering of some kind, a new piece of software, or something that they'd like us to really get captivated by. And so if you meet someone and they say, well, I've just developed a new location-based software for mobile devices that enables people who are lost to not only find themselves, but to find other people that might be in their group. What? Okay, so here's what I've done, is I say, who? Guy who's lost. What? Little mobile device. How do I know he's lost? Because where? I don't know where I am. I'm in this place. I don't know where it is. Okay, so what would happen if on that device I had the ability via satellite to tell you exactly where you are and put it on a map? That's how you use it. Now, I've gotten a drawing. I mean, we all know what this is. This could be Foursquare. This could be, you know, any GPS-enabled part of my mobile device. But the kind of thing that typically we would try to describe with words, it fails, or it's poor at best, or it becomes very forgettable. So if we just draw it out, now we've got a simple way to do it. And what we did is we said, who, what, where, and how. So we've got a flow chart on top of a portrait sitting within a map. If you just start, and every time I ever make a picture, I always start the same way. And it turns out that this, I know many, many people who do the same thing. If you want to try to visually describe an idea, instead of saying, I don't know what to draw, so I won't do it, just draw a circle. Just draw the first circle that comes to mind and then give it a name. And more often than not, it's just going to be me, and then make it look like whatever it is, and then say, well, if I'm the first circle, what's the second circle? Well, that's likely to be you. And then it will just emerge from that. I know it's quick and dirty, but if you want more examples, again, there's a book out there, so... I know that we had a guy over here with the red, with the lanyard who had a mic who was looking.
He went away.
He went away?
Aw.
That one. Yes. Yeah. No. No, he's referring to what's called graphic recording, which is large-scale content visualization, and that's what I've done for years. That is improvisational, so no. That's a very sophisticated form of doodling, and ultimately what that is about listening very intently and understanding how to distill information into its most salient points and then visualizing it, and it takes practice. And I have a book coming out in 2013 that's called The Doodle Revolution, Permission to Think Freely, and I will describe and teach that practice inside of that as the most sophisticated form, though, you know? But no, so that's totally white space, just let it rip, yeah. Thanks. Thank you. Yeah. Way in the back. That's a really cool, very cool question. For me, in terms of persuasion is really about what's embedded in the content. But I think that compelling, if you're talking about retention and the compelling nature of the act of creation, that's why live drawing is so powerful, because other people can witness the birth of what's happening. And because of the motion embedded in it and the fact that there's something's unfolding before their eyes, that I think that's the power of live sketching. But because when you're trying to do something persuasive, and you have time to crystallize it, then I think that the power of persuasion in an infographic or something that you put a lot more studio time in, I think that there's heightened persuasion inside of that because you actually have the time to be very clear about what you're doing rather than improvising what you're doing, which is what happens in live drawing.
Does that make sense? When it's live, nobody can edit it, so you get all the good stuff.
Right. Or the bad stuff, depending on the circumstances. Does that help? Cool. Yes. In the role of the eraser, what do y'all think about? Is that to me or is that to just anyone? Do y'all have an opinion about that?
Erase a lot. Yeah.
Paper's cheap.
Here's the thing that I would think something maybe interesting about the eraser is that I think that people, I don't think that you have to erase. I think that having iterations is a really cool thing to do. So I think if you're trying to work through some complex, sophisticated problem, it's totally appropriate to have a really shitty version of your answer at first, and then you can watch it evolve. So, but if you have a perfectionist tendency and erasing is what makes you feel comfortable, then, you know, go there. But I think to erase is to sort of accommodate that judgment voice, and I'm really more about not accommodating that judgment voice and just letting flaws be visible so that you can see how your thinking evolved. That's some deep shit. How you like that?
Can I just, like, completely disagree?
Yeah, totally.
I know we're out of time.
Totally.
We're totally out of time.
Oh.
I find that the best tool, if you want to encourage people, maybe later on in the process, you're right, the best tool to encourage people who are uncomfortable about drawing is to give them a whiteboard. Because you can erase it immediately. Mm-hmm. Because you're not committed to what you draw. See, the reason why I'm disagreeing is because I think that there's something about the live spontaneity of it, of just drawing out. I've got an idea. I don't know how to draw, right? We all say, I don't know how to draw. How would I draw a cat? Oh, maybe like that. Well, that's a terrible cat. So let me erase that one.
Right.
Can I erase that one?
But that's
wow!
That's
it's Microsoft PowerPoint.
Don't forget.
Yeah.
But that's the iterative process just in fast forwarded. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah. So I like erasing because it makes you not feel like you're committed to what you drew. You can try it again.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yes. So do y'all feel inspired to go forth and up-level your literacy?